Yeah, I think we caught that one just in time. Okay, so we're back.
How's it going, people?
It's kind of bizarre being...
Wait.
Out there.
Yeah, it's something that we've been delaying and we're finally back on the podcast. Fran, thanks for coming down and joining again.
No problem.
You know, it's always good to see you around and get these opportunities to really catch up and hopefully talk the real shit about certain things that's going on. And for those that are bothering to stay with us and to listen and for some reason wanna jam with us for an hour and a bit as we go through a couple of things, then it's
A nice one, isn't it? If you're like, still around, thank you.
And I've tried to listen to a past couple of ones just to try and catch off where we left off, but you know, I think listening to a few things has kind of reminded me why we were doing this in the first place, and I think I kind of lost sight of that a bit. And you know, it is sharing the message and taking all the interesting things that we hear and get an opportunity to speak to each other about it, but it's also an opportunity for us to kind of kick ourselves up the arse about certain things in life where we need to push ourselves a bit more. And I want to develop a bit of momentum again with the podcast, and once we get a few on the way, then you know, starting enjoying ourselves with it and start like trying to search for topics that we want to discuss and let it flow naturally.
Yeah, I don't think we've really searched for too many topics. Yeah, I don't know, I think a lot of it has been flowing, and that's the bit of feedback that I've had from some of the guys out there that have listened to previous podcasts. So yeah, it's part that I've enjoyed is the fact that we jump from random conversations to other things. Obviously, if people want to do their research on topics afterwards, they can do. So you know, it might be something we've just touched on, and it might spark something in someone else, and they'll do a lot of research into that, and you know, next thing you know, you've got a new expert in a new field.
Yeah, I was thinking about perhaps expanding the team and, you know, bringing in a couple more people to mix up the flavour a bit. You know, the more varied opinions and characters that we can get, I think it can take the show to a different place, and we can play around with it and see where it takes us.
Yeah, for me it's been nice. I guess even sometimes for me to document, it's, as you said, it's a way of documenting how we thought at that previous time. It's like I was speaking to another friend, when I was referring back to what I'd said wrong on a previous podcast, I was like, you know what, I said that bit wrong. I referred to myself as past me, and he picked up on it and started laughing.
Yeah.
He was like, only you could come out of a description like that. And yeah, I don't know, it kind of, you know, it is a past me, because although that was me then, obviously we're going a bit philosophical now. Yeah, that was the me of then, and then now, you know, like you progress to a new you, so it's like everyone's always constantly evolving. So it's like I was watching something, one of those motivational type speeches or some sort of documentary. And yeah, I think that was one of the points that they made as well, is that your past is all just an experiment. So everything is an experiment, and it's just obviously it relates to where you go going forward, but doesn't define it, because obviously in this moment in time you can choose to go into a field that you enjoy, for instance, or something that you want to pursue, a study or a career path, whatever.
And the I guess you've made significant progress in the career path, your chosen career path in the past, since the last time we spoke.
Yeah, it's been good. I'm now a NLP practitioner, which means mind coaching, basically. So into that sort of.
So for the people that don't know, what is NLP?
NLP is neuro-linguistics. I kind of got into it a few years ago, during a time when I was working, in banking for a little while. So I remember going on the courses and briefly touching on it there, and finding it was something that really fascinated me, how your thoughts and your wording and stuff can actually influence your behaviours as well. So, so it's literally just about reprogramming how you think and how you talk to yourself. The usage of words, for instance. Like a lot of people say, oh, I know I need to get onto that, but then I don't, you know. So then they always end up coming up with the excuse as to why they can't do it, or it's an inbuilt response, you know, because our brain is obviously wired like a computer. So if you're programming your brain in a certain way, then you're constantly going to have those habits. So you know, basically with this, you can catch yourself like nipping yourself in the bud, and then just reprogramming. So you're basically reprogramming your mind. So
give me a couple of like useful applications then. Why take an interest in it? So how do you apply that then? Give me a useful application for it. maybe like losing weight, or
yeah, you could do it for anything really. Or, I mean, like, you even get people
confidence.
I mean, certain of it is like, I mean, some aspects of it is also like to do with, I guess, self hypnosis as well. So where you're, you know, like, so you'll get people like experts in that field, like Kellner and you know, Darren Brown and all these guys.
Well, at least the television ones.
Yeah, the television ones. Yeah, they, you know, like they. Yeah. So it's just showing how you can reprogram your mind through looking at.
I remember because there was Ross Jeffries. For those that know a bit about the pickup world, Ross Jeffries is said to be one of the originators of pickup, and his techniques are very much around using neuro-linguistic programming techniques, trying to evoke certain emotions and attach them to a gesture or a movement or something where you hook something together.
Yeah,
so that when you're then later in conversation, when you kind of repeat that trigger motion or trigger word, you invoke those feelings within that person, whether they're sexual or whether they're, you know, sad. But it's something that, you know, I wanted to look into a bit more, and it's just one of those things that interests you a lot at the time, and you know, you don't really get time to dig into it. So
it
now
depends,
that you have, right?
It depends what your focus is as well. Because I guess maybe at the time I was trying to look for what are successful people doing in order to be successful.
So every time you tap, it's like poof, poof.
Yeah, sorry.
Because you're doing like the palm
that's,
one, and now you're doing the finger one.
That's the half oriental.
So there's like a thud in my ear, but go on. Sorry.
Yeah. Sorry, where were we again?
We were talking about neuro-linguistic programming.
Yeah, that, it depends what your focus is on, because
obviously
you mentioned it can be used for the pickup arts as well,
right.
Whereas a lot of people use it as models of success. So, so say for instance you want to get into a certain subject, I don't know, like maybe you want to learn boxing. So so you go and do your research on, you know, you'd look for the greatest boxers, wouldn't you? You'd look for, you know, like today's modern greats, and then you'd look for the modern greats of the past. Especially now with like internet access, you know, you've got such a wealth of information available to you. You know, even if it's just the best, I don't know, fabric designer or something, you know, you can look them up and find out what they do or what they did to become the best. So it's almost like choosing your model. It's like, you know, who your model is, basically. Like, so not to say that you just stick to one person and become that one person.
Like a bodybuilder may put... Or someone that wants to get big might have a picture of like a bodybuilder on his wall.
Yeah.
You mean that kind of, is that what
you're
talking
about?
Yeah,
back in the days,
that visual motivation.
If they wanted to be as big as Mr. Universe, and they might want to aspire to that, yeah. So, yeah, that's another way of, you know. I mean, yeah, the more you look at it, I don't know, like, I mean, it's got such a vast title to it to be called just one thing. I mean,
so but the fact that it's a programming suggests that it's like a language, neuro-linguistic programming, and it.
Mm-hmm.
And from the little that I know of it, because, you know, I haven't read up that much on it. But it is to do with, by tricking the brain, or maybe not tricking it, but teaching it a new way of perceiving something or feeling something.
Mm-hmm.
And the skill of what these guys do is doing it very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, say something to you in such a suggestive manner or such a way that strikes you, whether it be very being forward and sexual and kind of like, you know, when you make they call it making a big impression on someone,
mm-hmm.
the first big impression, maybe a job interview or something. but it's a technique that you can do in a very short time, and which you can then recreate. And similar in the training of dogs, I think, you know, these certain, by rewarding with a sugar treat for doing something, it's a form of like NLP, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so.
Would it be fair to say?
Yeah, although neurolinguistics is actually more based on language, so it's like language patterns that we have. So a lot of the time, you know, people will block things in their life, like, you know, someone gets angry, like, this person makes me angry, and it's like, well, how does that person really make you angry?
Mm.
You know, and then it's like they're just getting on with their lives, whereas that is somehow affecting this person, and they're making the blame go to a third person. So let's turn this down.
That's cool.
So,
No, you can leave it on a little bit.
Yeah,
no, I think it's nice to have a shout-outs to Damian Marley and Nas.
Damian Marley, definitely.
That fucking killer album is amazing.
Definitely,
you know,
is.
We'll run it in the background, but yeah, if you ain't got it already, man, iTunes that bad boy straight away. What was the name of that collaboration album?
Distant Relatives.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, if I had my Desert Island disc, where, well, you know, you can only take five albums.
Yeah.
I mean,
no doubt.
I would have to think long and hard, you know, to not bring that.
Hmm.
But we can touch upon that later on, you know, about rap and where it is today, you know, like your views on that. But yeah, so NLP, right? Where are you at in your course then?
I've done it on practitioner level now, so it means I can go out there and help whoever wants help. So yeah, I need to get something arranged, because I'm actually studying personal training as well, so that's taken up quite a bit of time as well. And yeah, I don't know, the thing is with me, I try and get involved with a few things. I can't seem to just settle on one thing. I can have time doing one bit, and then I'll go on to do the next bit, you know, and then I'll do the next bit. I like to vary up my time, so I'm choosing things that...
It's hard to know what you want to focus on.
I know, it's all going into the same gear direction, because obviously, like, you know, the NLP is related to bettering the mind, and then obviously personal training is related to bettering the body, so mind and body equals happy spirit, you know, so if I'm keeping those two happy... It's like, because everyone mostly goes on about training the body, but you know, also like studying this and other brain-related stuff, you know, like documentaries and things like that, you realise that you can actually, you know, they've done studies recently, can you actually, you know, increase your brain capacity and stuff, and it shows, yeah, you can. Every time you learn new stuff, you know, you're creating new neural passageways in your brain, creating more connections within your brain, so... and obviously they say that there's as many neurons in your brain connecting to each other as there are stars in the universe.
Mm.
So if you look at it like that, it's like, wow, you know. So you can obviously keep building those connections as well by learning new stuff all the time. So nowadays we don't really have an excuse in not trying to take up something to learn, or not even taking something up,
but just finding.
It's
impossible not to go...
Yeah.
You have to be an idiot not to want to learn.
But you know what it is? It's probably not so much that, it's just that there's so many distractions as well. Do you know what I mean? That you've got all these like different games and then there's all these other subjects, television shows, music, you know, like what do you want to focus on? You know, there's so much stuff to, what do you tune into? You know?
So we're spoilt for choice.
Mm. Yeah.
We're now in a position where it's not us meeting up in the morning and then going tracking our dinner, you know, smelling the shit on the ground, listening to the ground and trying to track our prey. Whereas the women at home are, you know, boiling up the soup base and getting everything ready for when the men come back with it. Then we all have a party and then we have a feast and everyone's happy.
Yeah, as long as you caught something.
And then every year you have those events where tribes from around will come and you do like your little mini Olympics or something. And everyone has something to look forward to. And there are some... civilizations or some societies today that fairly closely mimic that kind of environment, whereas they're isolated to a certain degree, or they keep to themselves, like, you know, the Amish communities and some in the Amazon and elsewhere, living their lives and doing it in a way that, like I said, resembles that of the tribal.
Yeah, it's amazing. But even looking at, talking about the tribal ones, I saw one recently where they were showing these these native people that had never been exposed to like to modern day food, and their teeth were perfect. No, there was no cavities, no rotting or anything. As soon as they got exposed to like to our food, like the Western world food, like all their teeth started to rot, and they'd never experienced any of that before. Literally within 10-15 years, their teeth were rotting.
But when you're out in the jungle like that, there's life growing everywhere. I mean, literally everywhere. So when you're out there like that and you're eating sweet things, or you know, eating sweet things like the junk that we do, and then you don't have the tools to brush the teeth, and things start growing in your mouth, like you get gum disease, all that's just stopped life trying to grow in your mouth. And you know, all that bacteria and plaque, that's just forms of like diseases of bacteria that are living organisms. Just as you and me, or a plant, or it's just a little army of them growing together, and they have their own communities and their own ecosystem and their own life, but it's just on a miniature scale. Yeah. And then when you look at AIDS and cancer and all that, it's just the same as the ever-growing ant population. You know, there's just billions and billions upon billions everywhere.
Yeah, well, it's like even soil life as well. Like I can't remember how there was. Yeah, I can't remember how many millions or trillions of bacteria there were per like inch of soil, per square inch of soil. It was something like 90 trillion or something.
Yeah.
So you think about all those different life forms, and they all get fed to the plants. Basically, the plants just rip up these little micro animals, suck up their intestines and guts, and they become like all of they come the plant basically with the nutrients for the plant. So that's where it comes, like, you know. Is there really vegetarians? Because even the plants are, like, you know, on a microscopic level, they're devouring all these microscopic insects and life forms or organisms. And then that obviously becomes the plant as well. That's one of the problems that we're having with modern day farming, and you know, the war about genetically modified food as opposed to organic.
That upsets me, you know, genetically modified food. Now I get. To a certain point,
but a lot of people don't understand that. A lot of people say, "What's the difference?" You know, that they don't really.
Yeah, well, I think it's not explained well, but what it has done is that it's been watered down now. So when we've heard it so much that people are a GM and whatever, they're just eating it, and I'm guilty of that as well. But to know that your food's been messed with in any way, shape, or form, but you know, when it says genetics, when you're going down to the genetic level. And modify means you're changing something, right?
Yeah.
That's what you're meaning.
But it's not even that. But obviously, if you've got a weight,
but it's exactly that though.
Yeah. Okay. It's not only that, but the fact that is that you can do that is because now, like, because they've been genetically modified and they've got like all they can actually patent those now, because those are actually designs, like, you know.
To cut you off is the Monsanto one.
Yeah, that's it. I was about to mention that as well. They mentioned that, and there's a documentary called Seeds of Destruction or Seeds of Death, which is available on YouTube as well. You can see the full documentary, and they show you the effects of genetic, you know, like what they see as a, you know, like what happens with the mice basically. So they gave some mice genetically modified food.
Yeah.
They gave one group organic, and they gave one other group organic sprayed with pesticide.
Yeah.
And they found that the genetically modified ones, they were having all the tumours and stuff, like stomachs, and everything. So, because obviously a tampering of DNA, it's not like, you know, so that obviously then goes into the DNA, it's not like food.
And like I said, it's not something that you can test the results, because it's something that you'll only know maybe in like 100 years or 200 years time. Are these genetically modified foods affecting us now?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we're feeling okay, but does that mean all my sperm are dead now, or they will be, or my sons will be, or what effects is that having on him? But going back to that Monsanto thing really real quick, they're notorious amongst the, you know, the conspiracy theorists, and also like with the Joe Rogan fans that know about the behaviour of this company. But their one crop they sold to Indian farmers, some maize or corn, but they undersold everyone else. But what they did is that this wouldn't reproduce, so it would only have one yield. And at the end of the year, once the crop was cut, normal seed would regrow, and the farmer has his life now.
Mm-hmm.
But all these farmers were done by Monsanto, and there was a crazy rate of one farmer killing themselves every 20 seconds for that whole year and going on. And it's
why was that? Because of the stressors, or
Yeah, because of the bankruptcy, I mean, just all their livestock and their living and everything gone, you know, and then this corrupt company selling you this plant that they genetically modify so it only has one yield, and then you have no money, then they can come and take everything, you know, it's fuckeries, and it's just one small story of all the fucked up stuff that's going on. And the more that you keep your ear to the ground and you know, find out from Vice, from YouTube, what's, you know, the kind of scams that these big corporations are getting away with, you know, not only getting away with, but it's, you know, deliberately going out and causing harm to people's lives and to the environment. You know, Carl Pilkington, an idiot abroad, goes to China, and I was there for 2 years, I've seen it, but it just reminded me again of that smog that covers Beijing and Shanghai and all the cities. And it's like, the funny thing he says is like, in England you can have a shit day, but at least you have a shit day and the sun can shine. Here the sun never shines, because if it does, it's like this thing through the kind of like this foggy screen. And it's, imagine living your whole life not having a day where it's just a clear sky. And I had to stop and think about that, and I was like, all this time saying, yeah, I would live in China in a heartbeat, it's like, well, really, would I live in a place where I couldn't see the sun? Because that's, you know, when you're in Philly, like I was in for my stag do in Boracay, when you're out in the sun, man, there's nothing better.
It's beautiful.
It's probably one of the best places that I've been to. I mean, 10 days we spent on Boracay Island, and there's just one lovely shore front, and they have these big like bamboo sticks all along the beach with like these plastic protectors, because the wind can be quite strong. So you can't, that kind of spoils it. You kind of want it to just open out into the beach, but you have these things.
I think that is, no, I don't remember.
Huh?
Have they got one all over the beach? Is it?
Yeah, it just covers the whole beach like that.
Really?
Yeah, but then
because I haven't been there for about, I think I went there in 2007. Mm-hmm.
But the reason why they do that as well is because at night it becomes a whole like restaurants and bars all along it, so they have that protecting, so people, they can put the tables and build their own like barbecue restaurants and karaoke bars, shisha places, just all the shit that tourists want to do.
It's nice,
fucking incredible there.
I don't know what it's like now, but yeah, when I went there it was beautiful. It was like a little paradise.
Well, there was a big Korean convention going on there. We saw a couple of Korean movie stars. They were shooting something on location. And, you know, Phil, he had a different kind of haircut, and he was wearing these round glasses, and, you know, people were mistaking him from, you know, for Gangnam Style Psy. Yeah, some people were asking for pictures with him. And, like, they would play that, you know, the Gangnam Style regularly, and, like, we'd always, like, point out Phil. And, like, I think he got used to it like halfway through, and he kind of started to enjoy it from that point. But he was like, that's not something that you want to go around and claiming to be, you know.
Yeah,
not
very much. Still, did everyone actually think it was him then?
Yeah. Because there's so many of us, it looks like he's there and he's got like a mini entourage.
Oh, right, okay.
With him, and you know, every night we were all like dressed up for like a stag thing, so it looked like we were kind of like part of a crew. But the infamous day where they bought me like a tiger G-string, like leopard print, tiger print thing, and I had to like walk a mile up a beach and back on the main road. I've got to say, the video was well made. You know, I was worried a bit more about, you know, I didn't want the footage to be too revealing, but it was more about people's reactions along the way.
It's good, it looked like you had a laugh out there.
Yeah, it's interesting going away on a lad's holiday. You know, there are days when you spend so long with the boys, you know, there are days where you just want to be by yourself. And you don't notice that living your normal life, but sometimes because you're all together and as you're walking through a mall, these guys want to stop off here, then you want to stop off there. It's very difficult. And then you go out to drink, and then because you're there on holiday, you can't leave early, everyone wants to stay together. And but at some point you just want to break away and just, what I'd want to do is just go sneak away back to my room and watch like a Family Guy. You know, I had like loads of them downloaded onto my iPad, and you just for that bit of that alone time, or listen to a podcast. I was gagging to listen to a couple of podcasts, you know, that, because I've been thinking about that, just like sitting on the beach, you know, and there's coconut juice that they just chop off the top, they chuck in a straw, it's a nice chilled coconut. Yeah. Sunglasses on, just listening to a podcast, and just like, ugh. That's the ideal place to do that kind of stuff. But going back to the plant life, you know, at Kew Gardens, one thing that went through my mind was the David Attenborough episode that he talks about all the different species and plant life. For those of you that don't know, the Royal Botanical Gardens of Kew houses one of the largest collections of plant life in the world. You know, they have very large, famous greenhouses in there where you can climb up to the first and second floors. And all the different kind of exotic palm trees and...
Yeah, that's gorgeous. I'd love to have a garden or one of those in my garden.
Yeah.
Just there.
Well, there's one flower in there, in the room that we walked into, where it blooms once every 4 years. And when it blooms, it's a massive plant. I mean, it's about a metre wide.
Is that the one that was on the Attenborough?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So it comes up, and as it opens up, what you don't realise and what they showed in the thermal is that it releases heat, like body temperature, human body temperature. So you can't see it, but from far. Then as you approach it, it's like a horrific smell. It smells nasty. Mm. And what it does, it's actually imitating a carcass, a dead body, so that all the life, the little rodents and flies that are going to get attracted to a dead body all go there. They get caught in the jus around the leaves. It all goes down, and that dead meat is what the plant uses for sustenance and to survive.
But isn't that the plant, like, has loads of little individual flowers or something, isn't it? And that's what all those beetles are there that go in there. They pollinate it. Isn't that
it's
the same one, or is that different?
Different one. This one's specific characteristic heats up because it was going through all the different amazing ways that plants will go to catch their prey. But I'd never seen one where actually you'd heat up. But not only that, heat up and release that stench, only specifically timed for when the heat is released so it doesn't waste it. So that heat rises above the forest floor and then it can attract from further around. And that's why there's not many of them, and they only do it once every 4 years. But when they do, they need to make a big event out of it.
Yeah, that's right.
And to kill like that. But yeah, the Kew Gardens, that's where they explain the story that within soil, when a tree grows its roots, when plants grow, I always thought that it was, all right, my root goes into the soil and then I'm extracting the water and the nutrients from the soil. Simple, but what in fact happens, 80% of the time, it was said that there's fungus within the soil that is so prevalent within the soil that it's actually that connects from the root of the tree or the plant, and that it absorbs the nutrients from the soil, and it's that kind of feeds it in to the roots. So it's like the middleman between the two. So it plays a massive part of that, and it itself kind of grows and expands from that.
Yeah.
And fungus is closer to a mammal than it is to a plant, you know, the characteristics within it. So it's a very peculiar species. And it's a living organism. That's the point I'm getting at here. And an interconnecting organism whereby, you know, it's all connects and it's all part of one living organism. The largest one they have on record is something 26 times of Kew Gardens. It's a fungus known that it's all connected together. And it kind of reminds me of that, what's that James Cameron film, the big one, The Blue People?
Avatar,
right? You know, when you're plugged into the universe and like, you know everything just by plugging in. It's almost like to the internet. It's like this fungus, this big... So if something's going on here, imagine that deforestation is going on here, and all of a sudden this massive acres and acres of a living organism feels that food supply is getting cut off here. It can kind of like shift towards that way and start wanting to go that way. Then you've got this massive underground living thing that, when you stop and think what a living organism actually is and represents, it's... And that's the biggest living organism ever. And it just kind of blew me away because...
Yeah, no, totally. There was a documentary, I think it was on the BBC, it was called What Are Plants Talking About? Or something along those lines, anyway, if you check it out. But what they were saying as well is one of the researchers on there, or one of the scientists she was studying, she was actually looking at how do the smaller trees actually start to grow. And so they put like a radioactive dye within the tree, injected it into one tree, into mm-hmm. the biggest tree there. And basically, like a few days later, they came back and tracked where all of that dye had gone to. And they saw that it was actually in the surrounding trees. The mother trees were supporting the baby trees.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you know, the nutrients from the roots were being fed to the small ones.
So they're following the flow of the food, kind of, how does it get distributed?
Yeah. So, and then she was like, wow. And then she said, like, you know, so basically everything is connected all underground. These all are underground networks mm-hmm. to like help the baby trees to grow, because obviously they can't get to the sunlight. So the mother helps them out.
Yeah.
Mother tree helps them out first in order to grow.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like they can communicate with each other. So if they're of the same, you know, the same species, they'll know that they're mm-hmm. they're like family. So they'll sort of co-create together,
yeah.
you know. So yeah, when she saw the Avatar movie, I'm just going back to that because that's what she said as well. She said, "Oh look, they actually read my research." You know? So yeah, she was out studying that, and yeah, it was a good. And I think for a lot of people did, because a lot of movies do that. They touch you. You know, the movies that sometimes touch you like that touch your soul.
The escapism, you know, yeah, when you just lose yourself in reality and you just kind of.
Or it's just like, yeah, I can relate to that. There's something deep within us that always resonates to those sort of mm-hmm. things. You know, so that's one other thing that I find a bit curious as well, you know, when you look at the older cultures and how much more connected they were to the earth. You know, like, so they respect water as being sacred. Like, I was watching a documentary on YouTube about the Indians. I think it was called Native American Indian Prophecies by Elders or something, Elders Prophecies. And they were talking about, you know, how like if they were still the mass or the majority in America, then they'd still be drinking out of the water, because for them, obviously all of the older tribes and stuff, water is a sacred thing.
Yeah.
Like air, fire, water, air, earth. So so yeah, at the moment we're not doing too much of a good job on all of that, which as goes back to obviously that other documentary that I was referring to, Seeds of Death or Seeds of Destruction, I think it is. That also touches on a bit more stuff like that.
It's a Seeds of Destruction.
Seeds of Death, I think it actually is. It's quite an interesting documentary. It's about an hour and a half or something.
Speaking of Seeds of Death, my mate threw up a picture on Facebook. These girls in one of the Nordic countries, I think it's Norway or Sweden, they do a project of what happens when they grow watercress seeds next to a server dishing out Wi-Fi versus ones that are not. Just a simple class project. Results, I don't know if it's the next day or the next couple of days, the ones next to the server, brown, dead, black, nothing. Like the seed just went decoloured.
Mm-hmm.
The ones away from it, like seeds explode, nice big green shoot.
Hmm.
All these ones, and it's like, fuck. So these gun girls, they couldn't have been more than 12. Six of them did a project together. They all won this award
mm-hmm.
because it got like recognition all across the world. Wow. Something so simple in design. You know, but you know, results so fucking clear and it suggests a lot. And like I said to you earlier when we were talking outside, that I don't know what the effect of like having this in my jacket pocket, this mobile phone next to my heart all day long,
mm-hmm.
or even more dangerous when I'm on the phone having it next to my brain.
Yeah. That's why I usually now I choose my headphones. I'm grateful for my headphones.
But how do we know that? All right, fine. It might not be. What's the difference of it there being there?
Oh, I don't know. At least it feels like there's not as much radiation or whatever.
But that's all in your head. That's your. Because for me, it could be. The fact that it's anywhere in this room could. Because I mean, it's receiving.
Yeah,
from somewhere.
Like, it's everywhere. I mean, there are waves everywhere around us. I mean,
if we could see them in the air,
satellite waves. Yeah, no.
And if we could see like what these Wi-Fi waves look like, because if my phone can receive it here and it can receive it here and everywhere in this room, that must mean that it's getting this wave everywhere in the room.
Yeah, no, you gotta wonder, because obviously the body is an electromagnetic instrument as well, you know. Yeah. We're made out of electromagnetic particles, you know. That's what's holding all of these cells together, you know.
We've got a charge. We do have a charge.
Yeah.
But we,
it's true. I think we charge on like a battery or something, isn't it?
Are we more positive or negative? Because within that, you know, that diagram of the electron or whatever it's called, I know where there's the proton and the electron and the neutron. There's one with the negative, there's one with the positive, and there's one with the. So I don't know, it kind of all balances out, although once you separate them, they become unstable.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we are charge. Yeah. We are just energy.
Interesting. You say that it becomes separated. I don't know. That goes back to, I saw something about Zulu legend saying that we were once hermaphrodites, basically meaning we were both male and female.
Mm-hmm.
So it's funny how you say, like, what was that word you just used? Like, not stable or something.
Yeah.
It gets taken apart.
Yeah. Hermaphrodites. What about the crocodiles that, you know, depending on what temperature their eggs are kept at, will determine the sex of the youngsters?
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, there's a lot of intrigue.
That's genetically modifying it, man. It's like, all right, if we want a boy, we do this. If we want a girl, we do that.
Just turn up the oven heat.
It's pretty trippy. But one experiment that I wanted to talk to you about is... it was an experiment done with rats, and, you know, I don't know how reliable the source is, but it was on the podcast I was listening to, that when they had two rats living together in a space, a confined space, you know, it's like a little rat cage, everything's fine, it's cool. Then they introduce six more, they go about, they eat, they do that, they introduce, you know, like now there's like 15 rats in the cage,
mm-hmm.
and it starts to get a bit more crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And then they put in 100 rats in this confined little space, and then they started to go crazy. That you'd have like rats, there was a rat in the corner just like nodding away like a crazy, like a human crazy mm-hmm. person would do, you know, just like, and there was fighting going on, and there was just like anarchy, you know. It's just like, it represents the kind of the attitude like that you get in the street, you know, the kind of road rage in the city combined, because, you know, look how many people are stressed and have those, what you call, you know, mental diseases, where it's, you know, you do that kind of, you see some young kids and guys in the street walking down where you know something is quite not right in the head. And basically say a lot of that is just the fact of being in proximity with so many people, that it can have these effects that, you know, we think that they're because of TV or this and that, but just this rat experiment. The more that you bring in, you know, you start to get those reactions that you see common with overcrowding, and it's like people start losing it, going a bit nutty, people getting short-tempered with each other, snappy and having fights and stuff. And it's one of the reasons why when thinking about where I should be moving next, thinking of maybe getting out of London and just going somewhere that's a bit more peace and calm. Your house is your domain and your castle and your home. You want to be in a place where you can feel yes, you know what I mean? It's like, I spent so much of my life living in a house where I wasn't happy, in the sense that I didn't, like, you know, every time I brought a girl home, I'd be like embarrassed to take her up to my room, you know, because the walls, no matter how much we cleaned them, because it was just an old shoddy place, it would always look a bit dirty. In the bathroom you could scrub as much as you want, but always have that look, you know what I mean? And when you grow up having that, the minute you get out, and when I moved to Eddie's house, and you know how he likes his like marble looking floors and the nice wood, you know, the fake wooden, but it's like nice, and then I felt like a king at that point. So now I'm looking for a house for myself and my wife and the children that are coming. You really start to think, well, what is the best that I could have? And what is realistic that I can have? How far apart are they? And they're not too far apart.
Mm.
Now, I don't want millions and millions where I want a big swimming pool and all that, but a place out somewhere like not too far from the countryside where I love to go on those kind of nature walks and my children to go out there.
Mm.
Travel down to meet family when you had to, but just on my big master bed. You know, maybe some old school wood around in the room, and you know, I've always wanted a big kitchen where you could have like a little, all the family and the children sit around this little kitchen table for the breakfast, and have a big dining room table. It's just a few simple things that I think, you know, will give you a happy life.
Yeah.
And Joe was talking about why don't you, the idea of a community where you live with your friends on the street as well. Why am I living, you know, in these houses where I don't know my neighbour and they don't know anyone? And it's just like, we've gotten used to this idea of living in communities where we don't know anyone. I mean, I think it would be pretty awesome if there was just like, I said to my mates, look, in 5 years' time, this is what we're going to do, you know. There's these new bills or something, and you get it. And then, like, you and your mates own just like a whole street. or something like that. I think the idea of like, so you each like a tribal thing, you have each other's back, you do things as a community, you know, your children can grow up strong together, you can have the daycare centres, and I don't know, I guess now that I'm married, you start to think a little bit more about, well, what are your priorities? And all this, you got your dreams and your priorities, and although the dreams are still there, you know, they haven't left at all. But, you know, I want to make sure the family piece is cool as well. I don't know, but it's good times though. It's like shit. 32 now, married. So, I don't know, it's been a good year for me. You know, Philly and Hamburger Stag Doos. You know, spending time with Anne as well was pretty good, as far as being able to catch up on. You know, he spoke of one thing that was very, it stayed with me a lot, was Bertrand Russell. Because when you go on holiday, you do kind of want to, you know, what is the meaning of life, kind of thoughts that go through your head. Hold on, I'll pull it up.
Yeah, but going back to those experiments of rats as well, I also saw something where they were doing, because what they're saying is they can compare our behaviour quite, you know, to obviously a lot of the other animals, such as rats as well. You know, because obviously they've got the same basic parts of the brain, you know, like how we've got the, you know, we've got a bigger limbic system, but obviously not as big as whales, for instance.
A limbic system?
Well, basically, like, so say for instance, with a killer whale, for instance, or killer whales, their limbic system is bigger than ours, which is their communication base, their communication field. So yeah, basically when they communicate to the others, it's almost like they're a bit more telepathic. So they work as a whole unit, for instance, like when the whales are hunting. That's why they can coordinate their attacks more, according to some of this research. I think it was in a documentary called Blackfish. It talks about how the limbic system of the whale is bigger, so hence they're more of a unit. So they actually do feel each other's pains, which means they're a bit more psychic than, or connected to each other as a pod. So they move together like basically like a swarm of bees almost.
Yeah.
But obviously, like, they looked at like individual intelligences, but they all work together in a unit because their brains are kind of connected in that way.
So what does the limbic system control?
Well, I don't know. I'm not really. I'm still learning a lot of stuff. As I said.
So when you say that, but you mean like they can be communicating via noise through the?
No. It's actually saying that they're that part of their brain which deals more with. I guess I can't remember if the word for it was telepathy. I don't know. It might sound a bit. Mm-hmm. A bit like, you know, but it might well have been anyway along those sort of lines, but saying that that's how their brains are a bit bigger than ours basically. Yeah. So they're more conscious, they've got more, so, you know, like, whereas a lot of the guys when they were hunting these whales, they wouldn't think twice about stealing a whale, like a baby whale, but then they'd see like the reactions of the family and how distressed they look. You know, they keep peering up to find out what's happened to their little one. Mm. And some of the guys there that were taking these whales, they were actually like, wow, like, they actually felt really bad. Like, you know, whereas they were told, like, be all right, you'll just take them away. But then they started feeling guilty with the way that the whales were responding to them. But anyway, that was a bit of a tangent, because I was actually talking about the rats. And so with the rats, for instance, like, what they were doing, they were showing how whether they're willing to share, for instance, or you know, so they put two rats inside of a cage, inside of a box, sorry, and they put one rat inside of a tube, so it's locked in there. So they were trying to work out, and the other one was free to wander around. So then they looked at that, and they flicked off the panel to get the other rat out to help him out. So it's just basically saying, would rats help out other rats if they were in distress?
Mm-hmm.
So it was showing that they had that natural thing as well. It's not just unique to humans.
Mm.
Like they saw that one of his buddies was trapped inside of a tube.
Mm-hmm.
So he was looking around it, managed to unlock him and got him out.
Mm-hmm.
So then he tried the experiment again with two tubes, one tube with food,
mm-hmm.
like loads of chocolate pellets or something, mm-hmm. and the other one with the rat stuck inside it.
Mm.
So what did the rat decide to do? He wandered around and he was looking, and instead of just going for the sweets, he actually went to help his mate out, and then the other rat came out, and then they worked out how to open up the other box together.
Yeah.
And they shared it evenly, like.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. They actually saw them sharing, you know, and they done this experiment quite a few times. And, you know, so if there's stuff there, they help each other.
Was it repeat results?
Yeah, it's repeated results as well. You know. So yeah, that's why now they're looking a lot more to animals, because they understand that, you know, obviously all brains are, you know, like programs almost, you know, like, so those are basic programmings into a lot of animals, those sort of behaviours, which we thought were exclusive to humans. So now we're having to look at how do we define intelligence, you know, because the traditional ways of looking at intelligence isn't quite working anymore.
Yeah.
Because we're starting to notice that, obviously, with those things, it's like the amount of research they've discovered just on creatures like whales as well, you know, like compared to even 30 years ago. I remember when I was a kid, I saw a film called Orca Killer Whale, and it was about this killer whale that took revenge on this fisherman or something. And yeah, he went out of his way to go and kill him. But, you know, so it's funny how, like, you know, people go from that sort of understanding to, like, the understanding we have of them now. So basically, in this Blackfish documentary, they were showing the... They were showing the effect of, you know, like these whales being kept in a fish tank, basically, because these guys are supposed to be out roaming oceans and stuff, so it affects them mentally as well, isn't it? You know, like how you were saying about being in confined spaces with humans, they're also seeing these behaviours in animals as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, but
and it does something to the brain, fact, you know. Putting it in close proximity, and because the brain is such a powerful tool that even in an animal, you know, it's for you to be a chicken and be locked next to another chicken in, you know, what they call battery farming. Mm-hmm. You know, it has to do something to the whole makeup of the chicken, in the sense that it spoils the meat. Mm. You know, if you're about to eat a chicken and you see that all the chickens, your one's not only paralyzed, but it's demented, you know, it's like biting itself and doing, you wouldn't want to eat that chicken. Because in your mind's telling you that's bad food. Mm-hmm. Evolution tells you by looking at it that's gone bad.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you don't see that, but you just get the meat at the end in a chicken burger, that's what you're seeing. It's like you're removed from all that. But if you saw that, you'd be like, no way.
Mm.
But because it's in a burger and fried, you're like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Because there's just some madness that goes on with our food before it gets to us.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I was even watching that as well. I think it was a How Do They Do That as well. Mm-hmm. And they even like, I was looking at the romaine lettuce because I thought, yeah, I like a bit of romaine lettuce now and again. Mm-hmm. And apparently they spray it with, one of the first things they spray it for is chlorine and stuff. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh man. Yeah. You know, but I don't know. I guess, you know, it's, unless you've got the time to grow all this stuff in your garden, or if you've got a garden big enough, you've got the time to invest in that.
Yeah. Well, when I go to a Sainsbury's or Tesco, when I see, especially I notice it in carrots and tomatoes, and bananas, sorry. The tomatoes and bananas is that they just seem so big and watered down and without nutrition. You know, some of the bananas you get, you just do it, it's like you bite it and you can just like just chew through it so easily, and then it's like you're not even kind of full afterwards. When I'm in France, those bananas there, same size, but you bite into it and it feels like you're biting into a meal. That quality of the banana is so just like, it's just like packed with goodness. In fact, the English, when you just snap it off and it's like, I don't know, it tastes like it's been diluted. And I see that with the tomatoes as well. It's like you cut, it doesn't have that bright redness of like when you cut one when I'm in France or something, you know, or just when you buy it from the market. Well,
apparently because obviously a lot of these things it's the transportation of them, isn't it? So a lot of them apparently are picked when they're green, and while they're in transportation, they spray them apparently with ethanol gas, which turns them red. So then they're ready for consumption. So I don't know, like. Yeah, I don't know. Me personally, I like to eat as much organic as I can. You know, if I can get organic, then I'm doing that. As I said, I saw that documentary on it, going back to it again. I think it was Fresh, and they were talking about the benefits of
you know, of medium-sized farming, how much it's much more productive than any one large monoculture farming. So I know I'm touching on that again, but I think it's important to be able to.
But then, as a farmer, you get bought out by, you know, those big supermarkets that are undercutting you because your technique is better. And like, I think it was you that was telling me that due to the crop rotation, that the fields get a chance to replenish.
The nutrients get a chance to come back
into it, instead of you trying to pump up these.
That's it.
These, you know, flavourless, nutritionless.
The cows go in, they eat the grass, they drop their load there. And then
they drop their fat shits everywhere.
They drop their turds everywhere. And then, yeah, the next day the chickens go wandering onto that farm. Or like a couple of days later, they use their claws. So they get to use their claws to like scrape through all the dung, like where all the where all the maggots and insects and stuff are. So they get to eat properly as well. And they get to wander around. And then the next day, like, yeah, and then obviously it gives time for the field to rejuvenate. They end up dropping seeds everywhere.
And almost mimic what it should be like,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. So, I'm down for that way. I think that looks pretty good.
And when you see things working like that, and it just works, and then everyone wins, and then... But...
Because a lot of the thing that other people might say, is like, yeah, but look at the way the population's going now. You know, so that's... It's like we have to do this in order to feed the people. You know, I don't know, what do you reckon?
There's obviously something that needs to be done, because did you know that in the States, since the 50s, the population has doubled? So, you know, just think how long it takes to build a hospital, right? And then once you've built one, I mean, I know hospitals that haven't really changed since I was born, like the one where I was born, the Royal Free Hospital. They'll upgrade certain wards, but, you know, it takes, you know, you don't revamp what you do until like 30, 40, 50 years later on, right? And when you've got an infrastructure that's set up for X million number of people, right? And then now you're getting these immigrants and all of a sudden you've now doubled that. You're expected to do what you did before, now you're doubled. Now you've got cuts, now you've got this, and you got this. So it spoils it for everyone because it's diluting the quality of service all the way up until the point where now you're at a burden, they privatise it, they take it over, and now they cut the budgets because they're a company and they need to make money for their shareholders. Every year they need to see profit margins grow. So you're making cuts and it suffers and suffers, so the waiting times go up and the quality of service goes down, and then everyone's doing the bare minimum to survive and pass their local tests, and you know, it drains the resources. And, you know, like I said, since the 1950s, doubled. Those are pretty big numbers when you're doubling. You're taking everybody that we've got. Now imagine you have an identical brother, you know, and then just think how many people there are.
Yeah, no, definitely. But I did also hear somewhere as well. I can't quote where from, but I remember they said that if everyone was to stand shoulder to shoulder, every single person on planet Earth was standing shoulder to shoulder, we'd only take up a fifth of Australia. So, you know, I don't know, it depends how you want to look at it, really.
Yeah, I mean,
there's a big world, it's a small planet, but big planet at the same time, you know. So, it should have enough, it's got enough to take care of everyone, like, you know.
Yeah,
a lot of the ancient cultures knew that, Every cure is out there already in the plant kingdom. It's just we've got to find it, and that's what they're doing as well. They're finding it, but obviously they're managing to patent it. So then, you know, I mean, obviously it's good that you can extract things that we would never have found now. So there's so many plus sides, and you can argue good and bad sides, I guess. But it all depends where your magnification is or where your focus is. So
yeah, I mean, and if you're one of those pharmaceutical companies, you know, it's, you learn that you spend millions and millions, and you know, they have a massive budget on research. You know, they go and they find these medicines naturally in the plant life and then sell it to us, and then they make a massive killing on it.
Yeah, well,
when it should be, I mean, I say it should be free, but you know, who am I to say that? You know, they're going out and getting it and delivering it for me and telling me what it's good for, but not like the mother herb. The green leaves. You know, it's funny how many of the cannabis properties are in a lot of the drugs that are available, but because they're put into a pill, they're they're isolated from the, you know, the other plant, the other plant chemicals that is, and it's sold under a different name, then it's all right.
Well, I don't know. I saw quite an interesting documentary as well. I think it was Michael Moore done quite an interesting one about the healthcare in America. I think it was called Sicko or something like that. So, I thought I'd give it a go. So I watched it, and yeah, it was actually quite interesting because he came over to England and he was surprised that he was going. So, how much, you know, like, he was in the emergency room and they were like, oh yeah, I've hurt my arm or something. Mm. He goes, how much is that going to cost you? And they're like, what? It's not going to cost us anything. And he was like, what do you mean? Like, he just couldn't get the concept of, you know,
it's healthcare, bizarre, isn't it?
And stuff. Yeah, because obviously healthcare over there, they went back to like history and showed like where they decided they were going to make profit on healthcare, like if they give people exclusive healthcare, and then I don't know, it's crazy. Yeah, but check it out if you want a little insight into that.
When Americans watch that, they're probably going to drop their jaw. Because just as I did when I was in, not the States, but Toronto, where it's just as in the US, you need insurance, right? And my back was killing, and I went into the hospital just thinking, alright, let me just at least find out what's going on. Just for the checkup alone, just to see the doctor, was like $600.
Wow.
And I'm like, I'm on holiday, I ain't got $600 to spare. And that wasn't for him to tell me what it was, that was just to see him. Then I'd have to go and then go for an x-ray, which would cost more, or I'd have to do this, that you completely take for granted in the UK. Because I was shocked, just as he's going, what do you mean you don't have to pay for it? I was the opposite of that. What do you mean I have to pay for it?
No shit.
I was very scared, because I'm like, imagine you have something serious.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's one of the examples. I think this guy cut off two of his fingers when he was doing some stuff at home, like with his DIY. Two of his fingers got shaved off. One of them got shaved from here, and the other one, this middle one, was shaved off, then his wedding ring. And then basically they said, all right, we can fix this one for $60,000 or something like that, $60,000, and this one for $100,000, you know. So, which basically he had to choose which finger he wanted, like, you know. And I was like, shit.
That takes the piss, man.
Yeah.
But they've introduced this new Obamacare in the States now. Have you heard anything about that?
No, not really.
I saw this video trying to explain what it is, but it's this new thing that he's implemented for the health system. I've mentioned it now. I'm going to check what it is. Obamacare. What is it? What is Obamacare? Alright. You've heard of it, but what is it exactly? Also known as the healthcare reform, is a national healthcare plan aimed at reforming the American healthcare system. Its main focus is on providing more Americans with access to affordable healthcare, improving the quality of the healthcare, regulating the health insurance industry. So what is Obamacare? It's the unofficial name for the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which was signed. Yep, so just so for the poorer people to have more access to good healthcare. Basically, you know, this guy, he's authorized more drone strikes than any other president.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this within the conspiracy world and with the real world, I mean, he's no one's favorite guy at the moment. Reason being is that when he came in, he had the opportunity to do something great. You know, things were just in a state, and the first black guy to come in and be a president. You expected miracles at that time, didn't it?
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, it's a sad thing to say, but I don't follow UK politics. You know, like the coalition government and all that bollocks. I don't follow it at all.
Yeah.
There's a really good picture in the paper of this, you know, like this guy that's meant to represent the six banks. You know, the Rothschilds and all the big banking families that are meant to own the whole world. You know, he's got a puppet on this hand, and this hand's got Labour and this hand's got Conservative, but it's the same puppet master that has his hands on both. So while you guys are trying to fight and decide who you want to vote for,
yeah, well, it's
like I'm in the middle. Whoever you vote for, it's me anyway.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's,
Well, that's why it's symbolism. Everything is like blue and red, isn't it? So it's the colours. Those are the main colours or the main primary colours that you use. But yeah, even a lot of superheroes. And I was watching Superman the other day, and Spider-Man, they're all blue and red. You know, a lot of their main colourings.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's interesting actually. I did like that the perspective they came from. You know, like with in the Man of Steel movie.
Mm-hmm.
I did like the perspective that they came in with.
Yeah, it wasn't as traditional as the. I mean.
Yeah, no, it kind of.
Good spin on that.
Yeah, it was. But at the same time, it's like the way that they emphasised it was pretty clever as well. You know, like that he was from a different universe or from a different galaxy, for instance. Because imagine that as well. Like,
it was more like an alien movie, that one, wasn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I guess they did kind of mix it in.
Like the Avengers, you know, the Avengers movie, I thought they went really deep with the whole idea of...
the interdimensional.
You know, Loki
well. Yeah.
And Thor going back in, it's like, hold on, this is just meant to be human kind of stuff. Because I've seen like Spider-Man, I've seen Hulk, the movies and those, and it's all about, you know, like you spill a chemical and you change and you become this. But this was just opening up portals into another dimension.
Next dimensions and stuff.
It's pretty sick.
Yeah, no, definitely. But that's what, because even the I watch a lot of the animated ones of theirs as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, Spider-Man, Superman.
I wish I got into that as a kid. You know, I wish I had the opportunity, but
didn't know, no.
It never was on. Or you know, things like Dragon Ball and things like that. I never. You know, living with Patricia and that, it was just like, it was just an opportunity that we never had. Well, I'm trying to find you something. There was this brilliant video. About the way wealth is distributed and people's perceptions of it.
Oh, yeah. Is that one 97% owned or something like that? I saw one documentary called 97% Owned or something like that.
Oh, but yeah, check this one out. That's the image. Oh, it's not there anymore. But you see that those seeds there are completely dead versus these ones.
Ah, yeah. Okay.
They don't grow near the Wi-Fi.
Hmm.
It's pretty scary. We're slowly being get cooked. You know how it's like a little bit every day doesn't affect you that much, so you can kind of survive it.
Hmm. Yeah, there's some people that go to extremes and they foil the interior of their house. I don't know if it's foil, but it's like insulated or so that no signals can get in. Have you seen those?
No.
I saw a documentary once on that as well, someone that was getting really, like, you know, just really bothered by all of these waves and stuff, you know, saying it's affecting them, so they've literally put...
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Okay, here we go. All right, pass me this. Okay, guys, you guys have to check this out. All right, so if you're at home now, go to wealth inequality in America. And then there's a video there, it's about 6 minutes long. You have to check it out. Hold on, I can't play on this because I'm recording on that. So let me find it on this. So we're gonna roly 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 poly. I'm gonna put this video on, and it's like, you know, one of those powerful videos that you get, and it's just 6 minutes and it just blows your mind. And it's just like, yeah, that was worth it. You know, the way that our generation is getting used to learning in short bursts. You know, that's the way we learn now, because we've got such a short time, like an attention span. It's like advertisement, this, and then you look at Coke here, and it's just like bombarded with like 30-second adverts. I mean, that's what really...
they were saying that's one of the things that makes it harder for people to sit down and settle onto one subject, is because our brains are so used to just being bombarded with quick hits of information. So it's, you know, for a lot of people, that makes it tougher to get into like learning or reading a whole book or sitting there trying to learn to play an instrument or whatever.
Man, that it's hard, man. And I've had a difficulty doing that recently. It's, you know, just sitting down in front of the piano for an hour or 2 hours, it's difficult. Picking up a bloody book, I mean, you have to fight yourself to stop picking up your phone.
No, I mean, that's one of the things that I learned in NLP as well, is that you can, you know,
A Harvard business professor and economist asked more than 5,000 Americans.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, basically, what I was going to say is obviously, like when you're in that confused state of mind. Going back to that as well. So when you're in that confused state of mind, that's actually a good thing, because being confused means you're actually learning something. So don't ever get put off being confused. So that's one of the things, you know, that puts everyone off, is like you're trying to learn a new subject and you're like, oh, this is really confusing. But the confusion part is your brain trying to create some new passageways, and you know, so yeah, basically keep going, learn that new stuff and create those new passageways, and then it'll become easier after a while.
Yeah, so when I'm reading a book, it's like the first time I have it, I kind of like think to myself, okay, there it is. So I try and read a bit more, then it comes a bit quicker now, you know, and it's like very frequent, every couple of sentences that you stop and you kind of drift off, remind yourself to go. Because I'm reminding myself so much, I'm kind of like not concentrating on what I'm reading. So I have to kind of go back and read it again. But then once you get into the flow of it,
yeah, that's like it, finding the flow.
Building that momentum.
It's like with runners, isn't it? With runners, they go out for jogs, and they say that when they get into a certain zone, then that's when they, you know, they forget about everything.
Yeah.
You know, they just get on with, they just get into a zone.
Same like when you go into the gym. It's not only do you get into a zone, but it's like the first couple of times that you are going into the gym, you're almost struggling. You're like, oh, I'm doing this just to, like, you want to get out of it, but then come 2 weeks in, you're like, oh, I don't mind staying an extra 20 minutes, you know, like, oh, I want to make sure that not only do I do my squats today, but I want to get in my biceps and my and, you know, my shoulders as well. So you won't leave until you do a good session. Whereas before, you just like, I said, I'll be here for 40 minutes, so I want to do 40 minutes. But yeah, it's that pain that that brain has that will stop a lot of people. And some people say that, you know, those barriers are put there just to say, well, how badly do you want this? You know, if you don't stop when most people say, fuck that, that's too much for me, then you know, it demonstrates that you have that extra skill. And one thing that I wanted to bring up today is there's a program called Kick-Ass Kung Fu. I don't know if you heard about it, but it's an alright show. A guy that was 16, like a little rude boy in London, moves to China, and he goes and to a Shaolin temple, and I don't know, about 5 years he dedicates his life there. So I mean, you see him do some of the Shaolin, some of the katas and some of the movements, and his posture is very good, and like he can do like the long hour stand on your heads and all that kind of stuff. So he's done the proper stuff in Shaolin, but he comes back to the UK, and there's 6 episodes, and each episode he'll go to a different rough area. So he goes to Tottenham, he does one in Kilburn, he does one in Hackney, and then he does one up in Manchester as well. But he'll get 5 local rude boys, and you can tell they're rude boys. And so he says, all right, we're going to do these exercises. So they have to do like bear push-ups, all this and that. And then he'll choose 3 to go to Hong Kong with him. And for a lot of the people there, it's been their first time leaving the UK, and they go. And then one of the exercises, they have to climb up this temple in Hong Kong on their hands and knees. And there's like 100 steps. Or 200 steps, but they have to go up on their hands and knees, and they have to come back down on their hands and knees. And one of the boys is like, oh no, I can't do this, I can't do this. And so he gives up and he sits out, and the other two do it. And then the kung fu that they learn there is crap. It's not all that good, but there's a brilliant moment in it where they have to do this exercise where they have to stand like in like a horse stance, and they brace their back with their arms in front. And 2 Shaolin guys start kicking them in the back. So it's like one on each side. Bam, 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 bam. So the guy's taking it left and right. And like, you know, these big strong, most of the guys on it, they're black guys. You know, you get a couple of white guys. Most of them like, you know, black from the hood, you know, UK. And usually when they get struck like that, they'll either curse out or they'll fight back or they'll do something. And you can see it in their face. And the whole few exercises before that, they have to hit their hands in like on the hard kind of, it's like a stone, like a beanbag with stones, you know, to develop strength and resistance. So they talk about this moment where they got really angry, like, you know, a fight that they had, or, you know, they don't like to get embarrassed, or and they take all that energy and they focus it on that moment. And when they think that they can't give up, or they want to strike out, or they want to swear, during this exercise, they have to think about it. So they're like, ah, you know, like all spits coming out of their mouth and they're breathing heavily. But he's reminding them, think about that place, think about that thing. And then at the end of it, they're like, and then out of all the days where they do all the exercises and they think that's a waste of time or they try to take the piss, that's the one day where everyone comes out of it, like a lot of Zen, they're like, yeah, I got pushed to the limit there, you know, for the first time. You know, if someone's brought me to this level of anger and I've been able to control it, usually I'd be striking out or I'd be fighting. So it proved to themselves that they can do it. And you know, when you do that for the first time, when you break a bad pattern of always giving up, and like when you're in class, like, I don't fucking want to do maths, I don't get it, I'm never going to get it, I don't want to do it. Or, you know, I hate school, I hate the teachers, they don't like me. You know, why do they always pick on me? You know, they develop that mentality. But it's people that are just like, they want to focus their energy on something good and something meaningful to them in their life. But maybe everything they've seen hasn't been meaningful or good. But when you get taken away to, and you see everyone respecting each other, leave your shoes outside by the door, no one's going to steal them, or, you know, living a certain way. And he always gives a set of beads to the student that does the best, and the one that's made the biggest improvement and everything. And it's nice, really nice to see that that change, because you think, shit, I could have been mugged by one of these guys not so long ago, but the fact that you see them 4 weeks later and they say, you know, I've had no fights, and, you know, I know how to control my anger now. And the fact that they had to struggle and live that way and push themselves where they haven't been pushed like that. Because I know how it feels sometimes, even just staying with, going out camping, it's difficult to fight through that night if you're not used to sleeping on the cold ground. People say, let's go camping. Why go camping when we can go and get a bed and breakfast somewhere and just chill in that nice warmth? But when you get forced to do something, and the morning you wake up, it's always that morning feeling when you're like, oh, this is all right, I got through the first night. You know, I used to like get a bit homesick when I went camping with school or something, but once you wake up on that first morning, it's like you've made it through the first night, and it's like, yeah, I can do it now. You're looking forward to meeting your friends and talking about the night before and this and that. But I just thought it was a very motivational program. Thought I was going to cuss at the beginning for the shit kung fu and for all that kind of stuff. It actually turned out to be, these guys took a lot of valuable lessons home with them. So although it was all set up and it was all fake, I really enjoyed it. And it's called Kick-Ass Kung Fu. But anyway, friend, watch this video. we'll play it loud so like it can be heard on. And again, this is called the Wealth Inequality in America. Alright, here we go.
There's a chart I saw recently that I can't get out of my head. A Harvard business professor and economist asked more than 5,000 Americans how they thought wealth was distributed in the United States. This is what they said they thought it was. Dividing the country into five rough groups of the top, bottom, and middle three 20% groups, they asked people how they thought the wealth of this country was divided. Then he asked them what they thought was the ideal distribution. And 92%, that's at least 9 out of 10 of them, said it should be more like this. In other words, more equitable than they think it is. Now that fact is telling, admittedly, the notion that most Americans know that the system is already skewed unfairly. But what's most interesting to me...
So that's how you think it is, right? Now the top 20 own about that much. And this is what the ideal distribution is, where the top 20... Cause in what Americans think, it's got about just over 55%. What the ideal is, that the top should only be having like about 25% or 20% there, yeah.
...is the reality compared to our perception. The ideal is as far removed from our perception of reality as the actual distribution is from what we think exists in this country. So ignore the ideal for a moment. Here's what we think it is again. And here is the actual distribution. Shockingly skewed. Not only do the bottom 20% and the next 20%, the bottom 40% of Americans barely have any of the wealth. I mean, it's hard to even see them on the chart. But the top 1% has more of the country's wealth than 9 out of 10 Americans believe the entire top 20% should have. Mind-blowing. But let's look at it another way, because I find this chart kind of difficult to wrap my head around.
Good old text.
Americans to just a representative 100 people. Make it simple. Here they are. Teachers, coaches, firefighters, construction workers, engineers, doctors, lawyers, some investment bankers, a CEO, maybe a celebrity or two. Now let's line them up according to their wealth. Poorest people on the left, wealthiest on the right, just a steady row of folks based on their net worth. We'll color code them like we did before based on which 20% quintile they fall into. Now let's reduce the total wealth of the United States, which was roughly $54 trillion in 2009, to this symbolic pile of cash. And let's distribute it among our 100 Americans. Well, here's socialism, all the wealth of the country distributed equally. We all know that won't work. We need to encourage people to work and work hard to achieve that good old American dream, keep our country moving forward. So, here's that ideal we asked everyone about. Something like this curve. This isn't too bad. We've got some incentive, as the wealthiest folks are now about 10 to 20 times better off than the poorest Americans. But hey, even the poor folks aren't actually poor, since the poverty line has stayed almost entirely off the chart. We have a super healthy middle class with a smooth transition into wealth. And yes, Republicans and Democrats alike chose this curve. 9 out of 10 people, 92%, said this was a nice, ideal distribution of America's wealth. But let's move on. This is what people think America's wealth distribution actually looks like. Not as equitable, clearly, but for me, even this still looks pretty great. Yes, the poorest 20 to 30% are starting to suffer quite a lot compared to the ideal, and the middle class is certainly struggling more than they were, while the rich and wealthy are making roughly 100 times
the that you're going to say is that
and in about the past 10 times that of the still healthy 30, middle class.
60 years, the middle class has been wiped
this
out.
This isn't even close.
There is no
reality.
More middle class. It's just poor,
here's
loads
of poor.
Here's the actual
distribution of wealth in America. The poorest Americans don't even register. They're down to pocket change. And the middle class is barely distinguishable from the poor. In fact, even the rich between the top 10 and 20 percentile are worse off. Only the top 10% are better off. And how much better off? So much better off that the top 2 to 5% are actually off the chart at this scale. And the top 1%, this guy, well, his stack of money stretches 10 times higher than we can show. Here's his stack of cash, restacked, all by itself. This is the top 1% we've been hearing so much about. So much green in his pockets that I have to give him a whole new column of his own because he won't fit on my chart. 1% of America has 40% of all the nation's wealth. The bottom 80%, 8 out of every 10 people, or 80 out of these 100, only has 7% between them. And this has only gotten worse in the last 20 to 30 years. While the richest 1% take home almost a quarter of the national income today, in 1976, they took home only 9%, meaning their share of income has nearly tripled in the last 30 years. The top 1% own half the country's stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. The bottom 50% of Americans own only 0.5% of these investments, which means they aren't investing.
If you're playing the game of money,
I'm sure many of these wealthy people
in the middle, they don't mean anything
very hard for their money. But do you really believe that the CEO is working 380 times harder than his average employee? Not his lowest paid employee, not the janitor, but the average earner in his company. The average worker needs to work
more
than a
month
to earn what the CEO makes in 1 hour. We certainly don't have to go all the way to socialism to find something that is fair for hardworking Americans. We don't even have to achieve what most of us consider might be ideal. All we need to do is wake up and realize that the reality in this country is not at all what we think it is.
Yes, the video highlights how different the reality is to what we think it is as far as the distribution of wealth. And it says America, I mean, I'm sure the UK is not far behind now. I mean, as far as we're like the little brother of America. But it's scary. Yeah, then when you kind of put it into perspective, what does that mean? You've got the majority of people going out slaving away and living a life where they're not happy because they're you know, they're on the graph, you know, they're below the poverty line. You know, you're kind of surviving to live, but there's a different way of living where you've got all the money in the world to do what you want. There was this
yeah, that's another level of
one thing. There's a Saudi prince quickly, he blew $9 billion. He had that money, and being a Saudi prince, just the extravagant life. He was like 26.
We say he blew it. How are they?
I don't know how the details.
A week, 2 weeks, a month.
I don't know. Maybe longer than that. Maybe a couple of years or something. But you know, that's me and you don't know what it's like to live that life.
Mm.
You know, to be in a position where none of your family have to worry about healthcare. None of the ones that you love have to worry about tuition fees or, you know, whatever you want, you can go do. You want to go skiing there? You can go skiing there. You want to go horse riding? You want a pony? You want a horse? You know, you want flying lessons? You want to be a pilot? You want to go there, private jet? How does the brain kind of... Because the brain thinks, well, shit, there's all this trouble in the world and there's all this, but all I know is the good life. And does it make you not care? Does it make you think, well, I've got this, so I want to protect myself from it? When you're poor, that's they say, where before you be rich, you should be poor first to truly appreciate what you're missing out on and what you're actually getting into. But, you know, someone said to me, gee, I hope you never win the money, you know, millions, because, you know, I don't want it to change you. I said, what? Would, you know, having millions and millions actually change who I am? I don't know. I think my goals would remain fairly similar. If, you know, the first time I was like, oh, actually, let me get a Porsche first, or, you know, it's nice little Ferrari. Then all of a sudden, you got to pay for your Ferrari. That's expensive. Then the Ferrari needs a nice big house to get to park it in. And it's, you know, very quickly the money goes.
Yeah, but I mean, if you got that much money, like, that's not going to go to anytime too soon. But yeah, obviously, you know, looking at a lot of that stuff, you can, yeah, obviously, anything's achievable. We're in a universe where any possibility can happen. So I think we're at the stage now where we can. You know, we can look to ourselves. You know, we have to take a step back, have a look at who you are, you know, where you want to go, like in life, and how you're going to contribute to, I don't know, I guess humanity. You know, we're a, you know, I mean, if you look at all the organisms in the world, like it's showing, like, you know, we talked about 100 monkey effect, you know, how that became like an ability, like known, like, you know, if you haven't listened to previous ones, basically they done a monkey experiment where they saw that some monkeys were real, and they didn't actually want the sweet potatoes with sand on it, so they used to feed these monkeys sweet potatoes. They used to wash the sweet potatoes in the water, that get all the sand off it, start eating it. So the babies showed that to some of the adults, then the adults started learning it, and then all of a sudden monkeys on other islands started doing the same behaviour as well, and now it's known as an ability within that group. And obviously we're the same with humans. They've done that experiment on humans as well, where they put a picture of faces within faces and stuff.
Yeah.
And the first time they aired it on television, only about six or seven faces were noticed. The second day they aired it on television, and then basically done the same experiment and showed that there was about 46, 47 faces in the face within faces.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, then
no, but the well, when you were saying that, if I learn it over here, the fact that one group of a species has learnt they've learnt it as well, even though they're not actually connected.
That's it. There's some sort of connection, like on the global grid there.
So how does that happen? You're saying through, like, are you suggesting, like, the rat thing theory that I told you, that we spoke about before, where you said that because you learn a certain skill in one place, then magically a group of rats, you know, somewhere else that hasn't had no connection to them, or at least no physical connection, they're now able to do that as well. They've learnt it as well.
Mm-hmm.
just purely because the someone, you know, someone within their species has learned it as well. Was that where you were going with that, or was
yeah, along those lines. So basically, like, and another experiment they did with rats, and I'm going back to rat experiments, is they got the smart rats to mate with other smart rats to see if the, you know, like, their offspring would be smart.
Yeah.
Then they got the dumbest rats to continually mate with the dumbest rats.
Mm-hmm.
But they found that each time, generations later, or generations down the line, that the rats, even the dumb rats that are mating with other dumb rats, would become intelligent as well.
So it kind of balanced out anyway, then.
Yeah, yeah, still balanced out. Everything, you know, nature naturally evolved to making things more intelligent, you know.
Mm.
So even though some of the generations might have taken longer to get to that stage, they still got to that stage as well. So obviously you can look at that, take that out on a macro level to humans, and you can see probably similar patterns as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, sorry, I was on time to get...
But there are some mad coincidences as well that you can kind of mistake for something symbolic, something with meaning. But the other day, I don't know if you've played this game called Candy Crush. You know, tons of people are playing it, and it's something you can get it on the iPhone and on the Android. It's like basically, if you get three in a row, then it, then that's a line, and then it disappears, and then it, then the blocks fall down, and it's almost, it's a puzzle that you need to complete. And you sign in with Facebook, so as you're playing it, you can see a big grid, like, as you go along, there's different stages. But it puts the pictures of all your Facebook friends of where they are on this thing as well.
Mm-hmm.
So as you're going through, you can pass your different friends along the way. And there's, it gets progressively harder. And there's this level that I could not pass, and I couldn't pass it for like 3 days. And then I found out from Maining that she hadn't passed it for like a week. So then we both sit down playing it, and then I get to a point, I think, shit, I'm about to pass the level, you know, because I was coming to the end and I could see that I was doing really well. And then she passes it and I pass it, you know, within like a minute of each other. And it's something that we hadn't been able to do collectively for over a week. And just that first time we've actually tried to sit down and play it together, it was just like the first time we both passed it. So independently, I haven't been able to do it for like 3-4 days, and she hasn't been able to do it for a week.
And then you both sat down and worked.
And we never played together anyway, and then this time we sat down and played together, and there was just like this energy, and and then the good fortune just happened and made it easy for
both. That's what Napoleon Hill describes as the universal mind. So basically, that principle is just a group of people, so like, you know, like guys sitting together. You know, you probably need to at work, you all say, all right, what's our goal? So this is our goal, this is what we're going to focus towards. So everyone putting their minds towards one subject is proven to be more effective if everyone's putting their heads and focus and attention into that one subject, so they can go off and focus and learn that. So yeah, obviously with more heads, then it, that's what he refers to as a global mind, or not global mind, universal mind.
Yeah.
So you all become in sync, and you're kind of bouncing ideas off each other that are just meant to be.
Is it because it happens to me, and I notice it as well, because sometimes I might have difficulty coming up with good ideas, but one skill I do find that I have is that when other people are talking about a good idea, I can immediately come up with really good ways of, you know, taking it in another direction or other useful applications for it and stuff. And I think hearing people be creative and stuff inspires me as well, and it gets my creative juices flowing. And it's I don't know, I guess it's a good thing to be, you know, regularly, you know, with conversing with these people and being in a position to help your mind. You know, that's a lovely environment for your mind to be in, when people are having these conversations that make you want to use your creative part of your brain.
Yeah, definitely.
And you know, I just love getting it into a thing when I'm passionate about it, because, you know, I can be very quick on the spot to think about good ideas, and I'll take it home a bit and I'll sit on it for a bit and let it simmer.
But yeah, go with it then. If it feels like a good one, go for it.
Just one thing that you know, is a big problem, especially for our kids today, but in people in general, it's our kids today, it sounds so crappy to say that, but no, I do see the younger generation and look at them as kids, because, you know, I'm 32 now. I'm at a point in my life now where, you know, I'm married. I can legit say that, you know, once you're married, you do, well, I guess it's a certain milestone that you cross, and once you get over that point, you kind of consider yourself to be kind of, I'm over now. If I was on the X Factor, I'd be in the overs column. I wouldn't be in the boys. I'd be in the over 25s. And with that, I guess you think that you got a bit of wisdom, you know, with those years, and you got a bit of wisdom. And when you see the younger generation, you kind of notice some of the flaws that they have, and that I guess that I have as well. It's that having a good idea but not being able to follow through. Like this podcast thing, that followed through, but that was after so many other things didn't follow through. And it's, you know, that getting a good idea, just writing it down, many people don't even get past that stage. They'll talk about it with a mate and, you know, they'll say how great it is, but then you get the people that will write it down, then you get the people that write it down, invest time in researching, pursuing it, and then, you know, doing what they can to take it to the next step, like this podcast, buying the mic, you know, paying for the online space, this and that, and, you know, 1,500 hits altogether now, so it's approaching the 2,000.
Yeah.
And that's taking something and pursuing it. That's why I felt a bit.
Is it that many? I didn't realize this.
Yeah, I was a bit disappointed that I haven't done it for such a long time, because, you know, I felt it was gathering good momentum. Like that's when we'll start back again.
Yeah. I find for me it's also a bit of a marker, like, because I'm developing as well. Speaking into a mic is still quite alien to me. Well, saying that, and obviously we're coming from a technological age where we're using telephones all the time. But yeah, I don't know. There's something different about sitting down and talking. Like, you know, sometimes like when I first started, like I used to notice it a lot more in the room, and, you know, feel, it took me a little while to feel a bit more free and just talk, you know. I don't know if it's because,
yeah. There is a flow and a pattern and a rhythm that happens when you're having a conversation. Yeah. Now, when you're having an awkward conversation with someone that you kind of don't really know or don't really like, it's a conversation that you want to get out of as quickly as possible, and they do as well. So the rhythm isn't, it's not a nice rhythm, but then there's that one where you genuinely meet someone and you just want to get into it, and there's a nice flow, and you can feel like it's such a nice feeling that you want it to continue like all night long. You know, like you said, you enjoy that conversation, you let it go all night long.
Yeah.
But sometimes when you have and so it's a flow and a rhythm. And when you're new to it, because your mind's thinking about different things, that flow and a rhythm that you should enjoy, that all that attention into that conversation is the enjoyment part. When I'm 100% giving my time and attention to you. But when I'm thinking about fixing up the microphone and trying to make sure that it's all equally balanced.
Yeah, because that even throws me sometimes as well. If you're like doing something over there and I'm talking to you, and I forget, like, I should just look to the mic and imagine, like, you know, talking, carry on talking, and so I get used to looking at eye contact. So when you stop looking at me, sometimes I'm like...
Well, I try and keep that up as much as possible, conscious that I'm trying to... There's a little production thing going on over here as well, that, you know, a small scale as it is, I'm trying to make sure that everything, so that it doesn't stop recording or do a long thing at the end. I just want to make sure it goes all smoothly. So
yeah, no, definitely.
Because I listened to the playback on some of the recent ones, and one was terrible quality. There's like when we intro with the Nas and Damien beat, it sounds really poor. Because there's a lot of feedback and stuff, but then there's some other ones where it's like it will be today, because you know the feedback on this is very good. It's very quiet, and you know, I'm really enjoying that now, that level of production as far as the audio goes. Because I've listened to the Joe Rogan original podcast as well. He celebrated his 400th one the other day, but the original sound quality was like ours. You know, now that, and then I invested in a set of speakers that, you know, the omnidirectional speakers that have helped take it to hopefully a higher level, at least as far as the audio enjoyment is concerned. But it does motivate you having the right tools to do it with. You know, if you're going to make a good go of it, then you should take the time and invest when necessary.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's a flow to it. And the bit that I look forward to when I do a podcast like this is the minute that I forget that the microphone's there.
Mm-hmm.
Once that happens, and then I don't have to worry about all the fannying around with all the volumes and stuff, that's when I can enjoy a conversation with you, and then I don't have to worry about what topics are we speaking about, or it's just that rhythm that we're looking for.
Then
once you hit down a path where it's a nice, you can feel, oh yeah, I like this beat, this rhythm that we got going on this topic, then you can both just like go down it. And it's I think that's when we should be get to the stage where the majority of the podcast is that natural, relaxed kind of
just more chatting. Because
when
we try and do things like we're going to talk about this, sometimes I'll just be like, oh, I don't really know too much about that. So, you know, which is obviously cool in conversation, because you obviously don't know everything and there's always new stuff to learn. But that's one of the things I enjoy about, you know, obviously the conversations as well, is that, you know, even sometimes we might bring up a point or a question, I wonder why that, you know, this, and, you know, and then someone come to you, oh, yeah, that was actually, you know, this, or, you know, pointing you in a different direction, or from a perspective that you wouldn't have probably thought of looking at before. So, because a lot of the time, that's one of the things that you realise also studying NLP is, what are really your opinions, you know, is, because everyone always thinks, oh, this is who I am, this is the person I am, this is me, and, you know, obviously at some point you made choices that, you know, have made that become you, but it doesn't necessarily mean you, because even like your beliefs, for instance, like, you know, you might be like, I don't like this food. Why don't you like that food? And it might just be that they didn't like it. It was their mum didn't like it or something from when they were kids.
Yeah.
So they never got to try it, but they already had the impression it was nasty and it was smelt like feet or something.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So, so it's put them off already, and then when they try it, they're like, actually, it's not that bad.
Well, take chicken feet as an example.
Chicken feet, yeah.
It's a dish that most people will puke because of the idea of it, versus everyone that loves it, absolutely loves it. Because, I mean, those people that know about dim sum, if you really know, you know about chicken feet, because there's three types. You got your black bean one, then you got your two cold ones. The one without the bone, which is that white Thai one. Then you got the red one without the bone, but most people would cringe and puke up at the sight of it, and
not we you, absolutely but it sounds love bit, it.
No, I love my chicken feet.
Yeah, and I had that in Thailand. We're out there. It's good.
When was the last time you went?
I think it was with you guys. 2009. Eight.
Yes.
A while back.
It's, you know, you should do the exercise that I did the other day, where you build out a timeline.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a bit of paper like this, then you start, okay, what year were you born?
78.
So
you're doing my age, isn't it?
So 1978 to now, 2013, just draw a line. And then you put in here like when you went to school, so this is your primary. And then you got your secondary, then you got your college, then uni, and then your work up until now. And then that's your life. So yeah, so then you're working. But when you break your life down like that, and then you put here, this is where you went to holiday, this is where you went to Thailand, you know, and this is where you had and all the major events. When you start to play your life back like that, you kind of, oh yeah, I did this, and then, oh yeah, I did this. And then you kind of get a perspective of where it fits in your life. Because what happens as you get older is that your brain just gets so confused. And what you think, your memory of something that happened isn't actually what happened. It's what you've pieced back and put together is what you perceived actually happened at that time. And it's sometimes good to go back and look at it and think, oh yeah, so I went to the that's when we did that in Thailand. And the second year is when we did the bungee jump, and the third year was when we went PP Island. And it's when you break it all down and then go back for your life and track back all the holidays you took. Because I've forgotten a lot of the places that I've been to. Mm. I've been to tons of places, especially around England as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like school trips that you went to. When you start to build your life back, it becomes this really colourful kind of like, you know, colourful timeline with everything documented, and it's nice that it's for you to keep with you as well. And it's like, oh, I moved out this house then and there, and then, you know, when you get like those letters that say, oh, where were you living in the last 5 years, and if you've lived somewhere else within that time, you know, write it down and from what date. And it's always long when you fill in those bank accounts and all that, but when you track it down like here, it's it helps to keep a track.
Yeah, it's interesting. What that brings to mind for me is another thing I saw in a documentary, saying that like all of the cells in our body renew every 9 years. So every cell would have died and a new one would have been born, which basically means that we're a new person every 9 years or something, like 10 years. And then you kind of think about it and you think, yeah, actually my mentality was different when I was around 9 or 10 to when you become a bit older, and then you start thinking, oh yeah, seeing the life differently, and then you get a bit older again. So I think it was like 7 to 9 years. Every 7 to 9 years, that all of our souls renew. So, you know, I thought that's quite interesting. That was an interesting little point.
But it reminds, because I was thinking exactly that. But the direction that I was coming from was that I watched a video of me the other day, like me coming in China when I was teaching, in the house party, and I looked like I had not a care in the world. And I was talking into the camera and I was like, yeah, I was talking about Descartes or something as I was drunk and stuff. But, you know, I could see the attraction that the girls had in that young deal. Because now I think I'm a bit way more boring than I was back then. And, you know, I would have loved to hang to party with that young kid. And then other periods of my life, I was way more confident than I am now as well. You know, sometimes you can go through something in your life and you forget who you are.
Yeah, yeah, that's it.
You forget the good qualities that you have.
Yeah, it's all relearning as well.
And it's like, shit, I have actually, not only do I have it, but I have actually been like that as well. Some people have the case where they haven't had it, but they still need to have the belief and they can bring it out and they can do it. But, you know, it wasn't so long ago where I was actually acting differently. You know, I was acting in a very more, I guess the confidence is still there. Now it's more laid back confidence before, but there's such like a passion for life, and it's, you know, and sometimes intelligence as well. There's like loads of facts that I don't know through Taima or whatever it, but I feel that my memory is it because it's being filled up with all this new information, all this stuff, you know, like every time you watch a YouTube video, how much of your geography lessons or your history lessons does that kick out the back door? And every time you watch another, you know, whatever it is that you bombard yourself with every night as you flip through your laptop, you know, it's just infinite bits of data that you're seeing now. And it's like, not only infinite bits of data, but you're seeing so much on the YouTube that just blows your mind. Incredible, incredible stuff. Like, simply David Attenborough show. You can watch that show and every show your mind gets blown away. If not just by the camera and the imagery alone, but just like, the different ways that animals mate. There's this slug that does a thing that with a female slug, and they have to like twist down, they form a goo, and then they slide down the plant by the thread of their slime, and they have to spin around, and as they spin around they make love, and then they come back up and they have to drop off, and it's just the most intricate procedure.
Yeah, going back to fungus, you were talking about fungus earlier. I was going to mention that I was watching one on PBS, I think it was PBS America, one of those documentary channels, and they were showing a fungus, how it actually works its way through a maze. So they put a maze on a table, and literally it had to find its way through one side and go out to the other side, and it managed to find the most efficient way of getting through the maze, and then it just developed the fungal trail, I guess, through the actual maze and straight back out the other side. So from side A, top left corner, to side B, bottom right corner, for instance. So yeah, it's really interesting, as you said. It's like a living organism, but it's not quite a plant. It's not quite a mammal. But they say also mushrooms are about 60% the same DNA as us. So that was pretty interesting as well.
Yeah, mushrooms have this crazy property of, you know, so powerful, being able to like break through concrete and through wood, you know, and when you feel them, they just feel so soft. Like you could just like flick a mushroom to bits. It's so soft, but it's this bizarre texture. And there was the stoned ape theory. It's something that speaks to, you know, what happened within the evolutionary cycle that enabled, you know, a more Neanderthal kind of brain to develop into something like a Homo sapien brain like ours. And one of the Stone Age theory is...
Is this Graham Hancock, is it?
I think Graham Hancock touches on it.
Yeah, that's really interesting talk. But go on.
But one of the possible theories is that they would follow these cows because there was a certain mushroom that grew on the, within the shit of these cows, and these mushrooms were, I can't remember the particular flavor of mushroom, but it's a very psychedelic mushroom that. Because you just need to ask someone that's had an experience on mushrooms, and you know whether they vote left or right or whether they whatever the fuck they say they are, whatever they believe. When someone takes mushrooms, they can't deny that they see these amazing colours and patterns and, like, you know, Egyptian style symbols and stuff. It's something that people repeatedly say, especially, you know, when you go in a lot of people go to Amsterdam, take it one of those hotels like Jay and I did, where it looks like the curtains are, like, dripping down, and when it has just, like, even a plain design, but it kind of it does have that bright kind of 3D floating around kind of imagery that is so powerful. Once you take a dose of that, you know, whatever your beliefs are, you kind of have a really mad experience, a really trippy DMT experience. Have you ever tried shrooms? No? Alright. The shrooms. There's actually a product, Shroom Tech Sport. You can buy on the Joe Rogan website. Hold on, let me try to find it. But yeah, Graham Hancock made two appearances now on the London Real podcast. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, yep, I've seen him on the Joe Rogan podcast. I've seen a couple of his videos, you know, interviews that he's given and clips online, but I don't know, I just find it, and I just don't have the time to pick up a book and start reading. I know you make time to do the things that you enjoy doing, but I don't know.
It's not even that. Sometimes I just think, you know, if I'm switching on the TV and I find a decent documentary, then I'll do that. But I guess sometimes, you know, I don't know, it might sound a bit boring, but yeah, I like to listen to audiobooks as well sometimes, just instead of, I don't know, like, I just want to learn as much as I can, I guess. I just enjoy learning stuff, which I never thought when I was at school. I never thought I'd be saying, like,
fun, learning new stuff is fun.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I'm just enjoying it. Like, there's so much stuff.
If it's
to
good
learn.
Stuff, it's amazing.
Feel like Johnny Five, innit? I just want to keep on learning stuff. It's like, do that. Or, you know, just even if it's just self-development as well, just helping yourself, because obviously helping yourself to get better, then you help other people as well.
You do, self-development. You know, whatever it is. Some will make you develop quicker. You know, if you do slow-ass progress, then you can do slow-ass progress. But if you just wake up one morning, which does happen, and you say, today I'm going to go and be... I love this theory. Is be the hero of your own movie every day. So if I said to you, because I heard that and I said, okay, but today I actually went through the motions of playing it out. I said, well, imagine we were filming your life and it was a movie and you were the hero. Yeah, how would your day begin? You know, imagine you were your best self. What would you do when you woke up? You'd probably wake up early, right? You probably wouldn't. You wouldn't lay in. If you're the hero of this movie, you want to be doing shit in the movie. You don't want the movie to be of you sleeping. You'd probably be eating well. You'd probably be eating good.
I'll be eating well. I like my sleep though, so I don't know.
No, but you probably might have had a good night's sleep.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah, you would have gone to bed early.
As long as I've had a good sleep, I don't mind, you know.
You had a nice beanie with you, you'd have had your things. You would have gone to bed early. But you know what I mean? So, right, already you're in that mindset of, like, then you know, you get a wardrobe that is suited for someone like that. You don't need to be Gucci Armani. You can be, you know, Zara top man, but it needs to be that look. You know, what is a look that you would like to be? And then actually focus, all right, because a lot of times if you look the part, then you can feel the part. And then it's like, well, what diet would you have? What are the kind of friends you'd be having if you were this Ben Affleck, Matt Damon kind of, you know, nice guys in these movies? You know, who would you want your friends to be? Yeah, and then, you know, what would you want to be doing as a job? You know, what would your hobbies be if you were in this movie? Then if you start answering these questions like that and that, it's like, okay, then you got your ideal, then you compare it to what your reality is, and then you compare it to, you know, what is the best possible reality that you could have. Then when you start writing it down like that, it's like, okay, if that's all it takes for you to live the life, because I mean, there's a lot of things that I do now that I'm very happy with, that the best possible me, I'd be happy if they did that. If it was just that it did. But there's some things as well that I really feel that if I were to bump into a better version of myself a few years later, you know, would I be upset or happy? You know, imagine I see this really like suave G, you know, pulling up in a Porsche and I'm driving my 106. You know, the other day I saw an old mate of mine that I hadn't seen for time, and he used to be like one of the more popular kids, and he drives by in this big sick ass Porsche grey one, and I'm in my 106, and I see him, I'm like, yeah, you feel it, and I'm about to beat my horn to get his attention. I'm like, wait, hold on, I'm right next to him. We're at the traffic light going onto this roundabout by Westfield. And then for the first time ever in my life, I was thinking, you know, I was kind of ashamed. Not that it's ever bothered me too much before, but I just didn't feel that I wanted that moment to be his first moment seeing me, because we used to be quite tight. You know, just like there, it's like immediately, oh, I bumped into G. He's like, he was driving this 106, you know, this small little, he doesn't know my story, you know, he doesn't know all my other successes, and it's like,
yeah. You should have had that sticker on the back, isn't it? My other car's a Ferrari or something.
Yeah. It felt really bizarre. Like, I don't know why I didn't just beep him and hello it, and just kind of, I guess the shame of like hit of what he would think. You know, he doesn't know I'm married. He doesn't know I got this house. He doesn't know I got, you know, this and that. But that shame of him just like seeing me like that and him just judging me.
Yeah, but still, at least it's good that you kind of reflected on that. Why did I behave that way? You know, and that's one of the things that
I was ashamed.
To help you develop as well.
So. I didn't want my good buddy to, and plus he was driving a Porsche, you know, it was just like,
yeah.
And it was a nice, you could tell it was like it wasn't a box though, it wasn't the cheaper ones, it was like.
You should have just got out and pretended you were walking.
No, we both drove up to, you know, by the Westfield roundabout, you can't just stop there.
I see, just leave your car there. So it's a seat there.
And they're just like, you just slowly scoot down below the height of the window, yeah. But it was. Because he's always been one of those guys that he felt he was going to do something big. Maybe not something big, but he had one of those personalities that, you know, I'm right about everything and I'm going to be the best. But he wasn't a cunt about it. You know, there's some other people that are really arrogant and have nothing to back it up with. And they always think they're right. But, you know, he was very, you know, there's a lot of things that I kind of learned from him, or I liked about him. At the same time, I didn't like it about him as well. I didn't like that he was always right. I felt like I wanted to try and compete with him. But he just naturally had that from, you know, he was very confident like that.
Yeah. They do ask about, like, the competitive, like, nature of, like, humans and... You know, like, so they've done experiments. I don't know if we've touched on this before, but they've done experiments to see about if they got students to design a certain thing for a certain project, a theme, and were just told to create, just to be creative with no competition rules or anything, and get on with it. And then they gave another test group, same conditions, like, yeah, we want you to paint this for this project, and the best one will win. So as soon as they made it competitive, it was actually stifling the brains of the people that, you know, that were studying, or, you know, that were working towards winning a competition, whereas the kids that were, or the students that were taught to create and just create for the sake of creating actually came out with the best, most elaborate pieces, you know, and it was showing that, you know, a competitive mind isn't always, you know, isn't always the best. It's also good to, you know, just get more in touch with your creative side as well.
Yeah. I mean, I played terrible at badminton under competitive situations, you know, it's... It's something I need to work on a lot more, but I can totally see what, you know, I totally see where that comes from, that the fact that something, I reckon there's actually a chemical change that happens, that, okay, the fact that you know there's competition, and okay, then what immediately pops into your head is judgment. People are going to judge me.
Mm.
If I do badly, then I'm going to look poorly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I at least have to do better than most people in my class, or need to do better than that guy. The minute that happens, so much is at stake, because you're probably going to get called out amongst everyone.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, you're going to know your social ranking, well, not your social ranking, but your educational ranking within that thing, and it's rooted down into your survival of the fittest, whether you like it or not. You know, people are going to like the one, appreciate more the ones that have better results.
I think it more goes to like when you go back to human roots and stuff. They say we would have lived in tribes of about 50 people. So obviously, if you're already, that's part of the fear, is to, you know, because obviously the rewards can be great if you go out and do your best and, you know, and you win the competition or whatever it is that you're competing in, and you know, that's a great reward as well. But yeah, sorry, where was I going with that?
But that's why people with that ability to turn those competitive situations into a time where they can excel and they can do well, and they focus whatever crap that comes with all the excitement and anxiety of being in something competitive like that, where you will get called out amongst everyone and exposed. Then, you know, once you're able to harness that, and it's a very difficult skill, and most people can't even do that. I have a great difficulty once I'm on a badminton court, you know, trying to take away what people, or what I want to try and impress people with, as opposed to going out there and play the shots that I've practiced and that I can do very well. And because it's such a fast sport, the minute you try to remind yourself to focus and to concentrate, you know, you're already like two points into a rally, and then it's very difficult to focus and concentrate. So it's
finding that zone, like what we were talking about earlier, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Getting into that zone.
Yeah, like, so something that comes with the practice, and like I said, you know, if it was easy, everyone would be doing it.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. Why should it be easy? Why shouldn't I have to struggle? Why shouldn't I go through times where I feel really shit about
it? That seems to be one of the main themes in our society at the moment. I listen to radio talks and stuff, is saying that everyone's always wanting the immediate gratification, so to speak, or, you know, like to have already achieved it without putting the effort in to study it, or, you know. Yeah, I don't know. Have you not seen that, or am I just...
Hold on. One sec. The reason I'm saying that is we're coming up to the 2-hour mark.
Oh, wow.
Pretty cool. I'm gonna play us out. I'm gonna get a little tune.
Didn't realise that was the time.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if I was feeling a bit tired. See.
Yeah, man. It goes fast, doesn't it?
Definitely.
That's why it's you know, I needed this, you know, just to chat it out. And like I said, you know, there were moments in it where it just feels like it feels like there's a nice flow and you don't have to worry about the microphone.
Yeah, so it's always an interesting experience for me as well, coming just documenting our conversations, I guess, about all the random stuff that we talk about.
And I call it like a time capsule. It's like when you listen back to this in 5 years' time, you hear the thoughts and dreams and conversations of someone that of your younger self.
Yeah, That's it.
And sometimes it can be very motivating, because it's like, if I said to you, what would you tell the younger version of yourself? You know, so if I said to you now, if you had a message to tell to yourself in 5 years, what would you say? So imagine that I'm here and I'm gonna record your conversation. Like, Fran, I'm gonna go to yourself in 5 years. Now I'm gonna jump in my time machine. And I'm gonna play in this little video clip when I get there. Is there anything you'd be keen to find out?
No, I don't know. I think just let it keep unraveling, isn't it? How time is unfolding at the moment.
Yeah.
Unless.
So see how it's going on. I'd ask him, like, say, well, you know, did we do what we wanted to do? Did we hit our goals? Did we make that cheddar? Well, I guess the other way around of looking at it is, like, if you were to tell Fran from 5 years ago.
Could even just do like a Bill and Ted thing and say, how many fingers am I about to hold up?
Four! No way!
It's true. But what would you tell the Fran of 5 years ago?
Just keep going. Just keep on doing what you're doing, developing. I guess like working on yourself. So it's, for me, it's also about not looking or criticizing other people, you know, because it's like they say, like, whatever you criticize about is normally one of your own deep flaws.
Really?
Yeah. So if you look at it deep enough, and it's like, or at some point you were that person, do you know what I mean? Or, you know, like how you were saying, oh, you know, 5 years ago I was a different person, like, you know, so you would have done things that, you know, don't know, different things, or, you know, like, just behaved differently because you were out more partying or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I don't know where I'm going off on that tangent.
Yeah, I guess where I'm coming from is, you know, I mean, I've been fairly happy with my direction in the last 5 years. Mm. You know, I have been lazy, I've procrastinated on tons of shit, and I think that's one thing I want to change the most, is saying I'm going to do something and just go and do it. Because I'm very good at saying, what I'm good at doing is having a list of 5 things to do.
Yeah.
And then breaking down all the week and the next week into filling it all in, so that I could free up my time, and the next day I'll go in and then, you know, I'll free up more time for her down, just so that I don't know, I keep procrastinating and shoving things backwards and backwards and until what the last needs to be done.
Yeah.
Been that way since uni. And
no, I'm sure if you look, you know, like, if I look deep enough, I'm think there's, you know, sure, I'm sure there's a lot of things in the last 5 years I would have done differently if I could. But then, you know, what's the point in looking back and saying, oh, I should have done this, I should have done that? Cause,
no, but the difference is if you could give some advice, you know, you bumped into him, because there are some moments in your life where you think, shit, that guy really said something and spoke to me. Well, an incident happens, you think, fuck, I learned a lot from that one experience.
Well, that's when
you
I started, key moments. Yeah, that's when I started following those moments a bit more, to be honest. So that's why, like, you know, just kept on going with that as well, isn't it? Like, I guess it's called coincidences, or, you know, so, like, you know, you meet people and situations happen, you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, if it's good, go with it. Interesting book, actually, on coincidence and stuff was, I think it was the Celestine Prophecy, like the actual storyline behind it, and the idea of the of, like, I think they even talked about a global consciousness as well, how, like, you know, we're all linked together and stuff.
I love it. I love that idea.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, some interesting.
Who's it
interesting
by?
Book.
Was it something Celestine?
Celestine Prophecies. I can't remember now. It was one of the books I read, like, about 2007 or 8 or whatever. And it kind of just made me feel a bit more like, yeah, I kind of feel that. But then obviously you look online, and when I read up about it, people were saying, oh, it's like supposed to be founding a new age religion and stuff. So you always get everything now. Everyone's always skeptical, isn't it, whenever new things come out, or
that resistance to change.
Yeah, yeah.
That we're all built in with.
Yeah.
But anyway, on that note, that was Rodriguez again. Those remember from the old podcast. That bad boy from Boston that made it big in South Africa. The tune was called I'll Slip Away.
Mm.
I enjoyed that one. But the 2-hour mark plus 4 minutes.
Yeah, I hope it's not been you know, hope it's not been a waste of 2 hours. Hope it's been productive, or at least got some of your thoughts going.
It's been good, mate. I mean, it's like, you know, we're not experts. We're not charging anyone for this. We're doing it for fun, and we just
want to
talk about these, you know, a couple of bits and bobs,
mm-hmm.
little bits and bobs that we hear during the week or that we think deserve our attention.
Yeah.
And you know, if it makes another listener, even if he just cusses us about it, if it at least engages him to think about certain things, then, you know, I think it's a healthy thing to do.
Because when I meet a lot of people, like if, you know, like if I meet someone fresh and, you know, like and depending on their background, for instance, if, you know, like a couple of guys I think that I met, they were working in office environments and stuff, and when I spoke to them about, you know, even just mentioning things about the universe or our food, how it's linked to, you know, us, you know, life feeds life, they go, "Oh, I never looked at it like that." So, you know, hopefully,
if you can just learn that one thing that blows your mind or that helps you appreciate something on a bigger level,
so
then
I think that's why we chat so much. Like, you know, like it's just different.
We've said so much and we've covered so much tonight that something's gonna strike a chord with you.
Like something
you're gonna be a motherfucker if you've heard us all night and you haven't at least once gone and think, "Oh, that's interesting. I'm gonna follow up or I'm gonna dig that into that a little deeper." You've gotta be a boring motherfucker. All right, fans. Anyway,
cool.
We love you long time. Alright guys, over and out. Take care.
Peace everyone, bye bye.